Welcome to Discover Indie Film. I'm your host, Jeff Howard, and I've got two people on Zoom with me. I've got Alan Wood and Sarah Sipniewski, and they're here because Alan's film, I'm going to be happily share the title with everyone, Life's a Bitch and Then One Kills You, played at Filmvasion Los Angeles in 2020. Hey, Alan. Hey, Sarah.
Hello.
Hi.
Good to have you both here. And your film was definitely one of my favorites of the festival. It was, of course, the festival that got interrupted by COVID. Everyone submitted when COVID wasn't a thing. And then COVID was a thing and it got hit. And I believe you guys took home an award, right? You took home Best Ensemble Performance?
We did, yeah. My cast took that one home. And they were all very excited about it. And, yeah. It was great. They were all happy about it. We had a good time.
So well deserved. I mean, it's kind of funny. I mean, I say things like this, and I'm not blowing smoke at you. I mean, there's no way that a whole cast wins an award if the director isn't doing a wonderful job, right? Because you can't get a great ensemble working, firing on all pistons if the director hasn't done everything possible to make that happen. So...
Oh, thank you. That's very kind. I appreciate that. Thank you.
I believe it's true. I mean, it's definitely true.
They're all very talented, and honestly, I just tried to stay out of their way. You know,
that's also a good directing choice when necessary, yeah. Right?
Yeah. It's you hear that when you know all the directing study that you do. That's one of the big things. Most of your job is finding the right cast, and then the other part of your job is staying out of their way. So, you know. Yeah.
And making it really possible for them to do the best work possible. Yeah.
Yeah, you want to provide a safe environment where they can feel safe to reach out, or, you know, reach their full potential with the character, or where they're not afraid to try things. You want to provide that supportive environment to the artist and let them do their job as opposed to, that's what I feel anyway. I mean, every director's different, but, I'm not a micromanager in that sense. I like to look for the best people for the role, give them the job and then help them where they need help. But other than that, let them do their job that they work so hard to perfect. So
for sure.
That's kind of my philosophy for that.
Well, before we hop into talking about Life's a Bitch, which I assume we don't generally shorten the title to Life's a Bitch, although And Then One Kills You is actually a really nice addition.
We got to calling it Labatoki on the set because of such a it's just the first letter of each word in the title. So we just kind of referred to it affectionately as Labatoki.
Oh, my God. I don't know if I could remember that. but anyhow, before we hop in, I don't know how you feel about giving spoilers. I know the film is probably like 2 years old to you, but where can people go see it?
If they want to see the film, they can go to milepost42films.com and it just scroll down. And when you find the Life's a Bitch and Then One Kills You poster, there's a link to click to, you can either read reviews, watch the trailer, or watch the actual film. So just click watch film and you can enjoy it to your heart's content.
Right. And it's Milepost 42, right? MILEPOST.
And then the number 42films.com.
All right. All right. Now people have heard it. It's up to you if we, honestly, I'm not too worried about spoilers. I think the movie is so funny that I'm not sure it's spoilable. You could tell someone exactly what happens and they're still going to laugh.
But still get some laughs.
Before we hop into it, I think I've warned you. I'm really curious what your inspirations were to get into filmmaking. What started you on that path?
Well, I've always been a huge fan of movies ever since the ultimate moment I had in a theater was when I believe I was 9 or 10, and I went to the theater and I saw Star Wars for the first time. And I just don't think I breathed through the whole thing because it was such this giant visual spectacle. I'd never been affected by a film like that before, you know, and I hadn't, again, sense until I saw Pulp Fiction and The Matrix, which I think both of those were in the same year, I think. I remember I never had another experience in the theater until I saw those two films, and I was just like, my God. But as soon as VHS cameras became available, we had one, and my friends and I would make these little movies. And so I've been doing it since whenever that was. And that was probably, oh my gosh, maybe when I was in sixth or seventh grade.
Right, like early 80s.
Yeah, yeah, right in that ballpark.
And that's when VHS cameras like were huge, right?
Yeah, yeah, like, oh yeah. Big
and
shoulder.
The tape deck part and the camera part, right, with a big cable.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're actually, I think we're probably exactly the same age, maybe, because I saw Star Wars in the theaters when it first came out, and I was like 9 and a half.
Yeah, I think, yeah, probably then. Yeah, I remember I had this large beverage and I didn't take a single drink the whole time. It's just very clear to me that that thing was still sitting. That was before cup holders, so it was sitting right in my crotch the whole time of the movie. And it's like, it was over and I just realized, oh my God, I haven't done anything. I just, as soon as that, yeah, it was. And then we saw the guy with the breathing problem come in right away. It was just like, oh my God. I mean, it was like my life was changed, you know?
And so you remind me of a friend of mine at the time. I told a story that he went to see Star Wars at age 9 and had to pee and then didn't, and figured he would like sneak out during the movie to pee. And he said like his bladder expanded, like tripled in size during the film. Cause he just sat there restricting himself for 2 hours. It was
nothing you've ever seen before. And then of course I had to go back like every week because, you know, once it's gone, there's no seeing it again. Yeah, in those days, you know? So it was like, if you want to see it, you got to go and go and go and go and go. I don't remember how many times I saw it, but it was probably more than a dozen.
Wow.
But,
wow.
Yeah.
I only got to see it three. I think our parents took us and then we saw it with some friends. And then our grandfather wanted to know what all the hoopla was about. So last time I saw it was with my grandpa, my older brother, my grandpa and I went to see it over in, you know, those theaters that used to be in Century City. Uh-huh. And yeah, it's a fun memory. But wow, 12. So you were absolutely hooked.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah. And, you know, actually, even before that, I wanted to make my own science fiction epic. And this was, I know this was in fifth grade. So whatever I was then. And a friend of mine, Chris Schaefer, I started writing this screenplay for it. And a friend of mine's name's Chris Schaefer. He and I were going to do it together. And I wrote this screenplay and it was my first screenplay ever. And it was all description. It was just pages and pages and pages of description. And I handed it to him. I'm like, well, what do you think? He's all, you got to get these people talking. So that was my first screenwriting lesson from my friend in fifth grade. And he did a rewrite on the first page and he had people talking. I was like, oh my God, that's way better. So we wrote this whole screenplay. I think it ended up being like 30 pages. It was going to be our big Star Wars epic. And we were building models for it. And my dad had this regular 8 camera. And we built these little sets on sheets of plywood with little model buildings. And we did like a whole dolly flyover thing. And we had little fires on it. And it just looked terrible, but it was kind of cool because we had like this board hanging off of the car that we rigged the camera pointing down. And we just pushed the car back as a dolly to get the shot over the model. And so we did a bunch of stuff like that, but we never actually made the film. We just did a bunch of little effects shots that we tried to figure out. And then when the VHS cameras came out, then we started going out and doing all kinds of little short films that we kind of edited as we shot because we had no way to edit any kind of final product. So we just kind of said, okay, cut here and then move there and then cut there and move there. So we made a bunch of those little films. And then as time went on, the DAT cameras came out with the little tiny little cassettes, the digital tapes.
Yeah.
And we did, at that point, we lived in Kansas and we did a documentary and that was with my current wife, but she wasn't my wife at the time. And we did a little documentary about the town for one of our relatives that was visiting and that kind of got us back into filmmaking. So there was like a gap from when I just stopped with the VHS stuff. And I lived in LA at the time, and just, I was an extra in some films. And I think just being on the set as an extra, I never really got the urge to try to get a job. I didn't think it would be fun. I was just sitting there looking at these guys for like 8, 10, 12 hours waiting for to do my thing as an extra. And I just like, this is miserable, you know? So I never really got the bug to say, okay, I should go do this. I just went off to other things. But we
really, so as a kid, you were really inspired.
Yes.
And you hit an age where you just sort of stepped away from it for a while.
Yeah. As a kid, I was really inspired. And then I thought, okay, maybe I'll try to get into movies. And I went down to be an extra because I had a job that would let me get away. You know, this was in high school, early college, right? And we were making those little films up into high school. And then I wanted to become an extra. And then I got several films where I would just spend the entire day, sometimes 16 hours there, you know, I was just sitting and just seeing their jobs. And it really kind of made me think, okay, well, I don't really want to pursue getting into this as like a grip or something, starting out as a grip or starting out something like that. It's just like, nah, this doesn't seem fun. So at that, I was playing a lot of music. So then I got into being in a band. So then I went off on the whole band track I was in like 4 or 5 bands, and we were playing shows at clubs and we were having a good time. And then eventually that all ended and I moved to Kansas with my wife and the woman who became my wife. And we got back into it by making this documentary with the DAT cameras. And then after that, we shot a film called Civil Wars with my two nephews. They were just, 6 and 8 at the time. And the whole plot was brothers fighting each other. And they actually had a lightsaber fight. That's when my soon to be wife wanted to get into visual effects. So at that time there were some rudimentary effects programs available and she started researching those and said, okay, let's have them have to a lightsaber fight. So she animated an entire lightsaber fight with these two. And it was just something for the family. And we thought, oh, that was kind of fun. You know, and then, but the technology wasn't available for us to really do films. So it was just kind of fun. And then I started writing screenplays. And all of my screenplays that I'd written up to this point, where we're getting closer to making the film now, over a period of years, I took classes. I did Screenwriting U, which I highly recommend to anybody who wants to be screenwriting. They have great classes. I took several of their intro classes. Then I took their master screenwriting program, which was incredible. And the screenplay I wrote out of that was called Jesus at the Bus Stop. And it went to Austin Film Festival and made it to a semifinalist. And that was my first screenplay. And I was like, oh, this is really cool. Because I guess Austin's kind of a big deal. And to get that, then they put me in a producer book and then it got optioned. And I was like, holy cow, you know, this is great. But nothing ever came of that option. And so I kept writing screenplays and I've written 13 features. And so I think it was my 10th. It was the second one to get optioned and it was a horror story and nothing came of that one either. And now by now people are making films on their iPhones and stuff. Cause I've been writing for maybe 10 years or so now, 20 years. The time goes by, right? And I kept writing and marketing and learning how to write and writing and marketing and learning how to write, submitting and submitting and following up. And it's just like an actor, you know, it's just audition, 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 audition. And then you get something and then nothing comes of it. And you know, it gets so frustrating. And then I saw a film called, and I wrote it down so I wouldn't forget because I knew my mind was going to go blank. I saw a film called Primer.
I love Primer.
I don't understand it one bit, but I love it. You know what I mean? Primer is one of those movies that's like, what did any of that mean? You know? But it kind of proved to me that, you know, okay, we can do it because Primer's budget was $7,000 because I looked into, you know. And I love that movie and it's a gold standard for people like us in micro-budget filmmaking to go, see, you can make something really cool. And
it's also, unlike Clerks and Brothers McMullen, it's actually good as a film. Like it's not just, a micro budget thing that caught fire. It's right. actually a really well written, well acted, well thought out, well directed film.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was, and then I got into movies like, once I started seeing what this whole thing was, where if you're going to try to do it yourself and what, what the likely parameters are going to have to be. Sorry.
No problem.
What your likely parameters are going to be, have to be minimum locations, no visual effects, no big car chases or anything like that, minimal cast, et cetera. I started watching like the Hitchcock films, like Rear Window and Rope and Lifeboat. And then there's 12 Angry Men also. All of those kind of like one room films. And I've always been a fan of films like, I don't know, have you ever seen Noises Off?
I did.
You seen it, Sarah?
When it came out, yeah.
Yeah, Christopher Reeve and what's that?
It's one of my favorites, Carol Burnett. And I mean, it's
just so frantic.
Oh, yeah. It was a stage play originally.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's one of the things they say, like, if you're going to make an independent film, a micro budget independent film, you go, you know, you're going to basically shoot a play. So I said, okay, so now I got to start out. If we can do this. And I talked to my wife, who was like totally on board with doing it, because she just missed doing all that stuff too. And she got really into photography by this point as well. So she was primed to do something. And we said, okay, so I got to write something then that meets that criteria. You know, we're going to do a single location and we're going to have a minimal cast. And I wanted it to be insane and frantic, like Noises Off, just nonstop, bang, 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 bang. And I thought maybe that'll help it not be boring, you know, because the number one sin in making a movie is don't bore them, right? If in nothing else, hopefully they don't get bored. So that's what I set out to do with Life's a Bitch. And then that brings us up to this film. Did that kind of answer the question?
For sure. And I wanted to, forever, I've been meaning to tell, to just state that Sarah's here to talk about, to join you when you're talking about a future project. And so we're not trying to be rude. She's not telling her personal story. I introduced Sarah in the beginning and then just asked Alan a question. And I thought, you know, some people might be listening to this and thinking, what jerks? They're not letting this woman speak. So Sarah's here to join in a little later. She didn't quite work on Life's a Bitch, at near miss. So the next thing is what Sarah did. But I was going to say, was Life's a Bitch an idea that you had sitting around? Or did you really just say, okay, I want to write for a budget. Here's my rules. And then you just came up with a story that could work in that.
That's what I did.
That's what you did.
That's what I did. And kind of my writing process is I get an idea. I run it by my wife, Melita McCarlin, and she's no holds barred. That's lousy. You know, that's no, don't do that. Or that sounds good, but what if you did this? You know, so I am so blessed to have her as a partner and a writing partner and a producing partner and everything, because she really doesn't let me get away with anything if she can help it. So
she's actually a lot like a producer.
Yeah, definitely. She's definitely a producer, big time.
Yeah.
But that's what we started with. I just had this thought. It started off that I had this thought in my mind. For some reason, I couldn't shake the image. And I guess this is disturbing in a way, but probably all horror writers have weird images in their heads. Maybe everybody does. I don't know. But I had this image of a girl in her underwear chained to a chair with a small table beside her in this room just by herself. And I kept thinking, maybe we could build a set in a garage of just this chair sitting in this with a wall behind her. And I was going to have all these Polaroid photos behind her just to give some production design to the room. And it also make it look kind of creepy. And I thought maybe we could do the whole thing in this room. And this guy comes in from time to time and brings her things. And we unravel the mystery of why she's there and what's happened, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But then I read an article in one of the trades that it wasn't a real good idea to have women be the subject of those kind of things at that point, of those kind of situations, So I said, I talked to my wife about that. And she said, yeah, it's probably better if we don't do that right now. And I said, okay, let's make it a dude tied up then. So that's, I said, okay, so that's where the opening image of Life's a Bitch comes from. I was just going to change it to a guy in a chair with a woman coming in, talking to him. But then we went on and we said, okay, that might be too little to do. And we have this house we can use. So let's just put him in a garage. And then who can this person be? And we just kept brainstorming the screenplay from there. And I didn't start out an outliner in writing, but now I am a total outliner. So I just outline all the beats and then I do my scene cards and then I get everything to go, because once I have all of that out, I can hit 10 pages a day and usually have a first draft done in like 10 days or less. But that's from a lot of prep work of getting all the scenes set and making sure there's no major plot holes that we can hopefully find all of them in the outlining stage.
For sure.
So that's what we did. And then that's how the screenplay for Life's a Bitch developed.
And I think I'm probably asked this in June of 2020 when we did a Q&A, but did you know some of the cast members in advance and start writing for a voice with them in mind, or all the characters are just written before you considered casting?
Yeah, I knew two of the cast members from previous short films that we'd done. I know Nate Lakem from a short that we did called Words With Who. And I knew Allison Scarlett J from another little 1 minute film thing that we did. We entered a 1 minute film contest. So we did a little thing with her. And this is an interesting story because it shows you like actors don't necessarily turn down things. Because she drove 2 hours out. Well, yeah, it was almost 2 hours to where we were shooting this 1 minute film. I called her the week before and I told her, it's a 1 minute film and you say one thing in it. You know, and I was talking to an actress about it, and she was going to do it. And then when she found out she had to drive out here to do it and she only has one line, and she said, it's just not worth my time to come and do it. And Allison said, I'll come and do it. And she came and did it, and she was such a joy to work with, and we loved her. And I said, okay, I want you in the feature that we're going to do. So she got that gig just by coming out and doing a 1 minute short and saying one word, you know? So it's just something, you never know what's going to lead to what. So it's just, you know, don't necessarily turn down something because you don't think it's worth your time to,
That's totally true. And that goes for people in front of and behind the camera, right?
It's Oh, absolutely. Yeah. 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 We've met just so many wonderful people in this process. And it's just, now it's automatically, you're going to call those people to work with them again, because, you know, you become sort of a family when you're shooting a picture like that. And so.
I bet. And then before we move on to what you did after that. So was your festival run just starting when it played at Film Invasion, or did you get in some stuff before COVID locked us in?
Yeah, I only got to go to one in-person event in Culver City Film Festival. And then everything after that was all Zoom, unfortunately. But
yeah,
that was great
timing.
Yeah. Yeah. It was great going to Culver City and sitting with an audience and seeing it and hearing them laugh at the right parts. And, you know, so that was a lot of fun. And we had a big premiere at the Lemley Theater in North Hollywood.
Oh, like a cast and crew screening, or?
Yeah. 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 We had a premiere night for that. And that was fun. Cause then we had our party after that, a premiere party at a bar that was just within walking distance. And that was a great time too. So it was just a giant relief when it was over.
So, it looked like everyone had fun and it came through in the film.
Yeah, it was our first feature after doing a handful of short films when we decided to step it up and give a feature a try. And yeah, we learned so much, you know, even with all of its flaws, it's still something that we just learned so much. And we just want to apply everything we learned to the next film. And then this film, everything we learned, we're going to apply to the next one. And we're just going to keep trying to grow a little bit with each film that we do.
So, you know, and as someone who enjoyed the heck out of the film, I'll say that, like, I know as a director, you're going to see flaws in it. But because it's made with such a devil may care attitude and and the cast and the characters and the script, it literally just bounces off the screen with fun and a healthy amount of, it's like both silly and sexy at the same time. I really think, like, I'm not going to say it's flawless, but I'm like, whatever you call a flaw, I don't think have any detriment to the viewing of the film. I think, you know, it's not like you tried to, you know, make a heart-wrenching picture and it doesn't quite affect our feelings. Like you sought to entertain and you entertained.
Right. Yeah. That was our primary goal. We want to make films that are sweet and funny and entertaining, you know, if possible. There's not a lot of sweet in Labatoki, but you know,
for sure. Labatoki, although there's some romance of sorts, I think. People
meet each other. Yeah. And that's how we met Sarah. She auditioned for the role of Janice in Labatoki. And from Sarah's audition, I knew that I wanted to work with her in the future. And so it was just a matter of finding the right thing. And then I had this idea for this next film that we did. And I just called her up. And I wrote that with her in mind for the lead. So,
which is, I mean, let's be real. Well, actors need to know that it's entirely possible that you read for something, you don't get it, and you still make a valuable impression.
Yeah.
I mean, you might be rare in this, but it's still possible.
Yeah, I guess there were a couple of rare things that happened. That was Sarah. And then and then some people come in, and then like Dana, we just knew it was her for the lead when she came in and did it. It was just like, there's just no question, you know. It's just, yeah.
Yeah. I think I might've said something back in June of 2020 along the lines of, I thought I was watching a well-oiled machine of an improv troupe.
Yeah.
Where, just all, I imagine it's probably what, 7, 8, 9 people total on screen together at times.
Yeah. I think it's 7.
And those 7 actors seem so comfortable and so well versed in their comedy together that I was actually surprised to hear you cast it. I was expecting you to say, I run an improv troupe. I direct the performances. So I grabbed the troupe and I threw them in this, like you clearly put something special together there. Cause You had me convinced I was going to hear that was a comedy troupe.
Yeah. Well, a lot of the cast, while we were shooting, several of the cast members took me aside and said, this is the best ensemble I've ever been a part of. You know, they just said, this is amazing working with these people, because I'm not 100% sure of this, but I think all of them have been through Groundlings. So they're all you know, comfortable with improv. And some of them more than others, but they never broke character, and they were all just always in the moment. And that was amazing. You know, it was just, it made my job so easy, you know, because someone would go off on a tangent and they would just stay in character and go with them, you know, and I wouldn't say cut, because you don't know if there's going to be gold or not, you know? So there's a lot of that stuff that made it into the film that wasn't in the screenplay. You know,
boy, and that's one of the wonderful things about shooting on digital, right? Is that,
yeah,
no, you know, it used to be every minute that went by, 90 feet right. of film went through, and
yeah,
you're
yeah,
like,
yeah.
We can't afford to develop this if we, you know, improv for 5 minutes, but right. instead, you can just let people go now,
yeah, just let them go. There was a scene in Labatoki where Quentin Gaetan, who plays Eddie, is going off about, I forget what he's going off about, but he's just talking and talking and talking, and the group is just looking at him, and Allison, who we met for the 1 minute film, is just burning him with her eyes. and he just continues to keep going. And I don't know, I don't think we cut much out of his speech, but when it was over, he was laughing. He said, "You can't use all that." And I said, "You know, it's really long, but it's funny. So, and if it's funny, it's probably going to stay in." But I mean, his whole thing wasn't in the screenplay at all. He was just, I guess he just felt an impulse. But again, that's the product of the environment that we create on set, the safety to let them experiment. So
for sure, for sure. And did that make it tougher to edit, or was it an easy edit?
It was an easy edit. One of the lessons we learned in that film about editing, when my wife's our editor, except for this current feature, we have another editor for it. But she edited that one, and she said, "Okay, from now on, even if they're improvising, we got to tell the actors to do the same thing every take, because you know, one take they'd pick up a glass, the other one they'd reach over for something else, or." You know, and so it's just a mess to try to get the coverage to match. So that was the difficult part of the edit, because no two takes were ever the same. So finding some continuity between the cuts was really difficult. Continuity of motion between the cuts, you know, so that was one of our big lessons.
For sure. For sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Excellent. All right. Well, I hope you had a good festival run, and,
it was fantastic. It was way more than we ever thought we were going to, you know, way more awards than we ever thought we were going to get, and, you know, recognition and people that seemed to love it. And it was very inspiring for us to keep going.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Right, so you followed it up with a short, I believe you told me, or you were working on a short and a feature concurrently afterwards?
Yeah, no, we went right into our next feature, which was this one that Sarah's executive producing and also starring in. And that one, I called up Sarah one. I either called or texted, I don't know. And I just said, "If you were a clown, what would your name be?" And she had no idea. I probably hadn't talked to you in a while, right?
Well, we had done that table read for that other project, so we had
talked. Oh, that's right.
Between, that's right. But then, yeah, then it was like a little low, and then randomly got a text from you about a clown name.
That's right. I wrote something else with Sarah in mind, a project that we're still going to try to do, but at the time we couldn't. It was going to be a bigger budget, and we weren't able to raise funding for it. So I said, "Okay, we'll put this one on the back burner." And I came up with another idea, which became the second film that we made. And then I texted Sarah and said, what would your clown name be?" And she texted back what it would be. And then I just ran with that. And so that was fun, because I know how Sarah talks and acts just from the audition and from that table read that we did as well. And so her voice is kind of in my head as I'm typing. So that made it easy for her character. And then the character that's her counterpoint in this new film is another guy we met from a short we were going to do but couldn't do because of COVID. And we knew we wanted him in the film as well, so I had his voice. And the third main character is from Labatoki, Kevin Nelson. And so I had his voice in my head too. So it was a lot easier to write the characters with their voices already in my head.
For sure. Did everyone have to come up with a clown name, or just Sarah?
Just Sarah. I came up with it. There's only two clowns in it, so I came up with the one for Will's character. Yeah.
You know, it's funny. It's almost a. You remind me of the film. One of my favorite films of all time, and I'm blanking on it, but the Jim Carrey one with the memory and the Internal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind,
yeah.
I believe was inspired by an artist who sent postcards to everyone he knew saying, "I no longer know you. You have been erased from my memory," something like that. And that's what started the whole process of that script happening. Was the screenwriter got one of those postcards and said, "Hey, so you actually, it's a really compelling idea. Just I'm dying to like text friends as soon as we get off this Zoom and say, what would your clown name be?"
That would be just like an out of the blue thing. I was like, well, why? Why do you want to know?
Yeah.
And, that'd be hilarious.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very cool.
Yeah.
And so that one came together and you've been working on it?
Yeah, that one came together. And Labatoki, we shot every Saturday for 11 weeks. So we shot that one in 11 days. And it was spaced over a long period of time. We didn't really want to do that again. Although it was kind of cool in Labatoki because it was like you're having your family over every weekend. After a few weekends, it was like, you know, hey, everybody's coming over again and we're going to play for a day. But this one we did just straight through. And I think it was 10 days, I think. Yeah, we shot it in 10 days straight. Just took some vacation and got that done. And it's with the editor right now. And he's working away on it. And then we actually have Sarah did a great job putting together a Seed and Spark campaign for this next feature. So we actually had some money to work with. And through that campaign, a composer who's a retired gentleman wanted to compose the music for the film. And he offered his services for nothing. He just wanted to do it because he loved the idea of the film. And, you know, he's got time on his hands. And so so we got a composer. And so, yeah, we have a lot of things we didn't have for Labatoki we have for this one now. So we're very excited. So it's kind of weird, though, because with Labatoki, you know, you live with it for the whole year when myself and my wife are doing everything. And so, you know, it's kind of weird that it's kind of out of our hands now until we see the first cut. You know, there's not much we can do with it. So it's...
Yeah, completely different process. But yeah. How different was it? Sometimes I think that films, it's really hard to do the one day a week or, you know, one weekend a month thing.
Yeah.
But sometimes I think it's a huge advantage because it gives you as the director and screenwriter like a week to think about how things went and then how you're going to do things in the next weekend. And, you know, you can do rewrites specifically for the voices you're hearing.
Yeah, that's exactly true. We did have, it's exactly what you said. You have a whole week to think about, okay, what did we miss? What do we need to reshoot? What do we got coming up? How can this be better? Or what should we do differently to make it less hard on us this week? Because we're learning the whole process. As many shorts as you make, it's a whole different deal once you're doing a feature. You know, we reasoned, oh, it's just going to be like shooting a short every weekend. Well, it wasn't. You know, there's a lot more. it was a big wake up call. So but having that time is excellent for this Clown Car Love Story that we're doing. It's we had to be ready to go every day, and so our days for my wife and I turned out, you know, 16, 18 hour days because as soon as I held every shooting day on Labatoki, I held the 10 hours. And I wanted to do the same thing on Clown Car. So we hit our 10-hour mark on every day except one for Clown Car. And after that, though, we've got to tear everything down, prep everything for the next day, and then go over everything we're going to be shooting the next day to see if we're ready. So, yeah, you're right. It's nice having that week to kind of chill and recover. And
it's just really hard to keep a group of people devoted over when it's one day a week for 11 weeks, because if you lose, you start losing crew, you know, an actor goes, hey, I just got this amazing audition. And
that's
you're very vulnerable.
Yeah. Our Dana's boss sent her to a conference in Chicago during the shoot. And she was flying back on Saturday when we were going to shoot. So that was one of the things we had to get around, you know, because she's texting us like at 8 a.m. Okay, I'm on my flight. It's not delayed. And we're starting to shoot, you know. So we rearranged the day to shoot scenes that she's in, but not her coverage until she got there. Right. And so luckily her plane wasn't late. She landed. She texted, I landed. She got to set by like 1 p.m. And then by then we had shot all the other side. And then we were ready to do her coverage and her in the establishing shot. So it's just things like that that you have to work with if you're doing it over a period of time.
Yeah. Yeah. Pluses and minuses.
Yeah. But you do what you got to do if you're, if you want to make micro budget films, you know, it's just, you just do what you got to do. That's, you just find a way to make it work. If you want to make a movie, you find a way to make it work and you do it. That's all there is to it, really.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? And I think one of the things I say to people sometimes is, you know, it's all about a labor of love at the indie level. And
yeah.
And, you know, if you cannot do it, then don't do it, because everybody doing it should have to do it. Like you have,
you don't have
that option. You're like, no, I want to do this so badly that I'm going to, even under these horrible circumstances.
Right.
I mean, even though they're not always horrible, I'm just kind of joking about the horrible, but it's tough. Right.
Yeah, it's very tough. I mean, you're limited with time, you're limited with money, you're limited with, you know, everything. But if you can find passionate people that are in the same boat as you, that they just want to create something and be around other creative people. I mean, there's a real sense of community that's very addictive, you know, at this level of indie filmmaking. I mean, you meet so many awesome people, and both my wife and I are like terrible introverts. We just, you know, the pandemic lifestyle is our basic lifestyle. You know, we're not really suffering. Because we don't do a lot of going out and socializing and stuff like that. But it's something different about the people when we get on a set with people. It's just, I don't know, maybe it's the like mind. Maybe it's the, I don't know. It's just a wonderful experience. And I agree with you. You have to do it. And then it's just
and
a matter
of. You're giving everyone on that set as whoever is the prime mover of the project. Mm-hmm. Is really kind of giving a gift to everyone else, because you're giving them the opportunity to do what they love.
Yeah, that's true.
Like there should be, I was taught by a mentor in the 80s, no, 90s,
okay.
That like always show respect for the person who raised the money or the person who made it happen. He's like, never, you know, just, he's like, that's actually the hardest thing. The hardest thing is to actually get the project rolling.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyone can sit around and say, I got a great idea. But, you know, the person who has the great idea isn't the same as the person who writes it. And the person who's written a great script isn't the same as the person who writes a great script and gets it done.
Yeah. Yeah. So a lot of times if I'm feeling down about something, we have the Labatoki poster hanging in the room in here, and my mom, my wife, what's that? Is that a Freudian thing? Oh my God. My wife will say, look at that poster right there. You know, we did that. And a lot of filmmakers don't ever get to do that, you know? So stop complaining and let's figure out a way to make another one, you know? So it's just, you keep that up there as a reminder that, you know, you did something, and that poster with the laurels and everything else on it started with a blinking cursor, you know, on a blank page. And so it's really kind of cool when you think about it, that
it's very able to
pull something off. Like, yeah, it's really, really cool. And I have so much respect for all the filmmakers. I love going to festivals and seeing everybody's films and seeing and just talking to them about their process and how they got it done. And it's just amazing when you talk to those folks, and they find all kinds of ways to get it done, even with no money. And they do amazing things. Like, I mean, how did you do that with no money? You know, it's just outstanding. And it's so much fun to talk to them, and it's inspiring as well. And it keeps me going. That's why I hope we can get back to film festivals. Everybody go to the film festivals. Even if you don't have a film in it, I love going just to see people and watch their films and be around them. You know, it's fun. It's just great.
That's fantastic. Yeah. We extended the Sherman Oaks Film Festival in November. There was so much pent up demand in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
When we were preparing for the November festival. In 2019, it had been a 4-day festival, and we booked the theater for 6 because so many submissions were there. And then we added a 7th, and then we added an 8th. So we actually ran for 8 nights.
Wow.
Because we don't believe anyone should have that 10 a.m. Wednesday slot. Like,
yeah.
We were 7 p.m. to midnight, but
That's awesome.
It was, it was wonderful to be. Actually, I hadn't gone back to a movie theater. So my first leaving home during the pandemic to watch films with other people was a festival.
Wow. That's very cool. Yeah. I try to go to all the ones that are local, you know, everyone that I can get to. I like to go and support and just Excellent. See the films.
Excellent. Well, here, Sarah's here. I feel like I have to direct a question to Sarah. So Sarah, how was your experience with, I believe I picked up the titles Clown Car Romance?
Clown Car, a Love Story.
Clown Car, a Love Story.
Yeah, it was a great experience. It was actually my my first experience as a lead and in a feature film. So I don't know. You might need to edit that out. Maybe Alan doesn't want that shared. We'll see about that later. But
no, it's fine. But, the truth is best.
But so for me, and like coming out of the pandemic, it was like kind of like, whoa, okay, this is like serious stuff. So I was like a little nervous, very excited, and I found that everything that Alan has said so far played out on our set too. It was like a big family and everybody worked together as a team. And, you know, on like, I had a couple of hard days, and Alan was right there to like talk me through it and get me into the space that I needed to be in. And so for me, it was like a collaboration, and it was like knowing that we were all in it together and we were going for something real and you know, funny and sweet and charming in the end. And you know, the words on the page, it was like, yeah, great, but what are you feeling? You know, who are you connecting with, and like how does that make you feel? And so for me, it was just a really like inspiring and authentic experience. And I think about it a lot now because I've been in class, like at a different studio now, and in person, you know, we're back in person, although now we're not, but anyway. And like, I've changed so much as an actor, even since shooting that movie. Oh my gosh, I would do all these things differently. But I think that's just the nature of the beast. Like as Alan was telling his story about his first feature, I'm like, wow, I can really relate, because like the next time I go out for something, it's going to be just like a totally different experience and process. And I'm just looking forward to that growth. So I hope in the end for Clown Car, you know, my hope is just that it turns into something that people just can relate to, and they find really like real moments despite the wackiness, because it's like a really wacky thing. You know, this, you're sent into the world of legit clowns. So, you know, take that for what it will be. But I had a great time. I thought it was an honor, a privilege. I was so lucky, is how I feel. So lucky.
That's excellent. It's funny. It occurred to me thinking about this that, Alan, you have a very good instinct for using sort of iconic, doing something fun and new with cinematic icons like witches and clowns. You know what I mean? Like it's fertile ground to do something fresh with.
Yeah, I thought the whole Clown Car inspiration was like, what if that these people are really, really into being clowns and it's their lifelong dream. And it's you know, someone gave me the advice, and I forgot who this was and who the quote was, but it's like, tell a simple story with a couple of complex characters in a marketable genre that's a few degrees removed from anything else out there. I don't know where that quote came from, unfortunately, but I think that's a great quote. And I just read it off my computer because I have it near me, because that's my mantra for writing these independent micro budget features that I'm doing, you know? And so that's exactly what we did. Try to do with Lab of Toki. We're doing with Clown Car. But with Clown Car now, we're trying to tell, there's a lot of real emotion from these two people that are in this really weird situation of this whole clown verse that seems to exist that no one knows about. You know, none of us civilians know about this and all the things they have to live up to. And then it's all the insanity that ensues throughout this picture. But yeah, so thank you. That's a big compliment. I appreciate that.
I just happen to notice that these are, by the way, I've heard that quote before too. So
yeah,
it's a good
I need, if I ever come across it again and see who it's attributed to, I got to add the name, because that is my writing mantra for that quote. And by the way, Sarah, she said she was like nervous when she came on set, and because of the scheduling, we had to shoot her most emotional climactic scene. I think was either her first or second day. I forget which day it was. It was the first day. The first day of shooting, she had to completely lose her mind emotionally. And so she had to come out of the gate for her first feature on set the first day and just lose it. And she did an amazing job. I mean, she just killed it. But, you know, I felt bad. It's like, well, don't break the lead actress on the first day. But she just, she went to a dark place, and it read beautifully. And I think it's going to be very, very powerful for the end of the film. So yeah, shoot the climax on your first day. Not recommended, but couldn't avoid it.
And I'm sure it happens. I'm sure it happens a lot. And it was probably great training.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it was great training.
That's what I meant. All right. Well, anything else either of you would want to chime in with? We're creeping up on an hour, so I don't know if you if there's some subject we've missed.
No, I think we're good. I don't know what else.
All right. Well, if you want, I mean, we're going to do have you both answer those four questions in a second podcast. But we'll wrap this one up, and then we'll have the fun one where we just discuss other movies.
Okay, that sounds great.
But I guess you want to repeat the website again?
Sure, yeah. If you want to see the film and also find out about how Clown Car is coming along and where to see that one when it comes out and our other short films that we're working on while Clown Car is getting finished, you can go to milepost42films.com. And click any of the links there to find what you need.
And did you ever live near a highway and you were near the 42 milepost 42?
No, the whole 42 thing is my addiction to The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
So understood.
The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy book appears in everything we shoot somewhere. It's somewhere in the film. And so 42 is all over the place in our films as well. So that's all just my personal addiction.
Understood. I love it too. Although amusingly, I tried going back on one of the, I don't know if it was Amazon Prime or whatever, but I tried watching the BBC TV series based on it.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, I loved it as a kid, but, ooh,
not
too
so
horrible.
Much now.
Horribly dated. Boy, do they do no justice to that book.
Yeah, I can't really watch any of the films. I just like reading the book. I mean, that just needs to be a book for me.
Yeah, for sure. I still tell my stepdaughter all the time about the scene at the restaurant at the end of the universe where the cow comes up and is talking to them, and everyone is shocked when he's like, "I can't eat a cow I've talked to," and everyone else goes, "You would eat a cow you never met?" So
yeah.
I see where some of your sense of humor comes from. Douglas Adams, a wonderful inspiration.
Oh, yeah. He's amazing. Him and Monty Python are just, big for me.
Me too.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I will. And Sarah, is there anywhere? Hey, is there a website or social media handle people should look you up on?
Yeah, totally. You can follow me on Instagram. Sarah, Sarah, _ Sipniewski, Sipniewski. See if you can find that one, and I'll give you a prize.
Well, Sipniewski is definitely easier. Well, you have a unique name.
Yeah.
I'm one of 700,000 Jeff Howards. It's kind of, I realize I like my anonymity, but then the fact that that Googling me is a pain in the ass. I'm like, I should have like changed the first letter of my name to like a K. It'd almost be like Jeff, but I'd be Keffrey. I don't know. All right. So anyway, I'm supposed to wrap this up now.
Okay.
I'm going to name a bunch of websites and social media handles. This is the Discover Indie Film Podcast, where we talk to filmmakers from the festival circuit. I program two film festivals. And Discover Indie Film, Alan's film's a feature, so it's on his website. But actually, a lot of the short filmmakers who've been on this podcast, we put all the short films together in an anthology on Amazon Prime. And I highly recommend people watch it. It actually, part of the Indie Purge, now we're not free included with Prime. It's 99 cents an episode or $7.99 a season. But every season is 10 episodes, half hour, two or three shorts. And they are wonderful, purely independent short films, handpicked from the festival circuit. So if you go to Amazon Prime Video, hopefully on a big TV, not on your phone, never watch movies on a phone, and go to Prime Video, search for Discover Indie Film, and please enjoy. And by the way, the Discover Indie Film Podcast, subscribe, like, give it 5 stars, thumbs up, whatever service people are listening on, you know, I might as well ask for 5 stars. And on the TV series too, if people want to go to Amazon.com, and because most of the time when you're watching Prime, you can't give something 5 stars. It's weird. So you go to the web, Amazon.com, and look up in the Prime Video section, Discover Indie Film. Hopefully you've watched it and enjoyed it. Give it 5 stars. All right. And of course we talked about, Labatoki, which is Life's a Bitch and Then One Kills You. And that film, that Alan made, won awards at Filmvasion Los Angeles. That takes place every June here in Sherman Oaks. And that, if you want to learn more about it, it's filmvasionla.com. And on social media, it's at filmvasionla. And I believe during the interview here, I mentioned our Sherman Oaks Film Festival is the sister festival of Filmvasion LA. That takes place every November. And it's shermanoaksff.com. And at Sherman Oaks FF on social media. I'm supposed to mention one more thing, as if anyone's still listening, because I've been talking too long, which is just for, I can curse, it's for shits and giggles. We're doing a second. We did a thing in January, actually a week ago, called THC Cinema. And it was purely independent movies that are even better when they're great, but they're even better when you are stoned. And so if you can't figure it out, on April 20th on 420, we're going to hold a second THC movie night. I'm sorry, THC Cinema. And if people are interested, go to thccinema.com or at THC Cinema, 2 C's in a row. And yeah, I can't help it. I watch, honestly, to tell the truth, if I'm ever desperate for material, I might say, hey, Alan, you want to screen Life's a Bitch and Then One Kills You again as part of THC Cinema? Because I have a feeling Life's a Bitch and Then One Kills You would kick ass with a stoned audience.
Probably. I bet it would. So, yeah, by all means, go right ahead whenever you want to.
I mean, it's supernatural. It's fun. It's funny. It's fast-paced. I bet it'd be the crowd pleaser. Well, if I'm ever desperate, I'll come right to you. You'll get an email from me.
Okay, sounds good.
All right. Well, thank you, Sarah. Thank you, Alan.
Thank you so much. That was a wonderful, wonderful time. Thank you for having us.
I'm glad you enjoyed it. And I'll thank everyone for listening.
Bye-bye.